Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Anna Mateo and Brian Lynn. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, Russian President Vladimir Putin was sworn in for a fourth term in office on Monday. Speaking in Moscow, Putin promised to follow an economic program that would improve living conditions across the country. He said that improving Russia's economy would be a major goal of his next 6 years in office. Economic growth slowed because of a recession. Russia observers have linked the recession, in part, to international sanctions against the country, saying Russia must use all existing possibilities. The 65-year-old leader promised to work for a new quality of life, well-being, security, and people's health. Under his leadership, Russia has regained its position as a world leader through military action, including intervening in Syria's war to help its president. Yet Putin has been criticized for doing little to reduce Russia's dependence on energy exports or develop its manufacturing industry. Russia's economy was hurt by low world oil prices and sanctions linked to the 2014 takeover of Crimea and military involvement in separatists in eastern Ukraine. Between 2014 and 2016, the Russian ruble lost half of its value on international currency markets. In 2017, Russia recorded small economic growth, with the ruble recovering some of its value. But the value dropped about 8% more last month after the United States announced new sanctions. Putin said, "Russia should be modern. It should be ready to accept the call of the times." In his speech, he spoke about Russia's international role only briefly. He said, "Russia is a strong, active, influential participant in international life." He admitted that Russia faces problems, but said that the country has always faced those problems and succeeded. Putin was re-elected as president in March when he received 77% of the vote. He has effectively been the leader of Russia for all of the 21st century. He left the presidency in 2008 because of term limits, but was named prime minister and continued to lead the country until he returned as president in 2012. Putin became acting president on the last day of 1999 following the surprise resignation of Boris Yeltsin. He was elected to his first four-year term in 2000. Russian state television broadcast the swearing-in ceremony. It began with Putin working in an office, then putting on a suit coat to begin a long walk through the building housing Russia's Senate. He then got in a car for a short drive to the Grand Kremlin Palace. Thousands of people attended the ceremony in person. One of the most famous was former German Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder. He is now chairman of Russia's state oil company and one of the loudest Western voices arguing for an end to sanctions against Russia.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. Commuting is a part of life for nearly everyone. At some point, we all need to use the roads to get to where we are going. However, in some places, commuting comes with risks. Each year, over 1 million people around the world die on roadways.
This number comes from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, or CDC, in the United States. The CDC adds that road traffic injuries are estimated to be the eighth leading cause of death globally, and they are the leading cause of death for young people aged 15 to 29. And it says that by 2030, road traffic injuries could become the seventh leading cause of death around the world.
Most of these deaths happen in low- and middle-income countries. In 2015, the 10 countries with the most road deaths were Libya, Thailand, Malawi, Liberia, Democratic Republic of the Congo, Tanzania, Central African Republic, Iran, Rwanda, and Mozambique. The CDC reported in 2013 that among high-income countries, the United States has the highest number of road deaths. The National Safety Council, or NSC, says that 40,327 people died on U.S. roads in 2016. And in 2017, that number dropped to 40,100.
However, the NSC says that drop is not a sign of progress. The organization explains that 2016 and 2017 saw the steepest two-year increase in road deaths in more than 50 years. The safety organization adds that speeding and texting while driving were two main causes for the increase.
The countries with the fewest road deaths in 2015 were Micronesia, Sweden, United Kingdom, Kiribati, Switzerland, Netherlands, Maldives, Denmark, Singapore, and Israel. There are steps that governments and citizens can take to lower the number of road deaths. For example, when people in South Korea wanted to cut road deaths, many different groups worked together. They attacked the problem from many directions.
The government changed and improved the country's Transport Safety Acts, regulations, and guidelines. They started using cameras to record where speeding and running of red lights were an issue. Engineers in the country also improved the transportation infrastructure, the physical environments where people drive. In dangerous areas, they built new guardrails and better roads. They also built speed control devices, such as speed bumps. Non-governmental organizations worked with governments to educate their citizens on road safety. The government updated the process of issuing driver's licenses. Many groups created information campaigns aimed at teaching the public about the dangers of drunk driving, speeding, and other high-risk behavior.
From 1992 to 2014, these efforts resulted in an almost 60% reduction of total road crash deaths in South Korea. Among children, the reduction was much higher. A report from the World Economic Forum says that during that same 22-year period, South Korea reduced road deaths among children by almost 97%. In 1992, 1,566 children under the age of 14 died in road crashes. In 2014, only 53 did. Experts at the World Economic Forum say that they knew of no other country that had experienced such a large drop in only 22 years.
Road safety experts say one of the most effective measures in preventing traffic deaths among children in South Korea has been the creation of school zones. A school zone is an area within 300 meters from the main entrance of a school. These areas have stricter rules and regulations. For example, usually the speed limit is set at under 30 kilometers per hour. The report states that drivers caught violating traffic rules in these zones receive a more severe punishment than in other areas. If caught speeding in a school zone, for example, a driver may have their license suspended. As of 2012, there were more than 9,000 school zones in South Korea.
Now let's talk about Sweden. An article on the World Economic Forum website explains that in 1997, the government announced a plan to reduce the number of road accident deaths to zero by 2020. Officials call it Vision Zero. To achieve this goal, the country made changes to the roads and created new policies to enforce traffic laws. The country changed traffic patterns to make roads safer. For example, city planners increased traffic circles and reduced intersections. They added more pedestrian bridges over roads. An article on the Economist website states that pedestrians crossing streets are protected by zebra stripes, flashing lights, and speed bumps. Also, bicycles are separated from oncoming traffic. Government officials also made the country's drinking and driving policies much stricter. These rules have helped lower the number of people caught drinking and driving. Since the plan began, road deaths in Sweden have been cut nearly in half. In 1996, 541 died in road crashes. In 2016, only 270 people died.
As governments and community groups take steps to make commuting safer, individuals can help too. Whether you are a driver or a passenger in a vehicle, or whether you are biking or walking, there are things you can do to make your own commute safer. On its website, the CDC lists these suggestions. Always use a seat belt in every seat. Even on very short trips, make sure to buckle up.
Make sure children are always properly buckled in a car seat, booster seat, or with a usual seat belt in the back seat of the car. And make sure you are using the safest seats and buckles for the child based on age, height, and weight.
Do not drive after drinking alcohol or taking drugs. Help others do the same. Also, do not ride with anyone who has been drinking or taking drugs.
Obey speed limits.
Drive without distractions. Do not use a cell phone to send text messages while driving.
Be very careful when crossing streets. If you are traveling in another country, become familiar with its traffic laws.
Ride only in legal taxis. Try your best to only ride in ones that have seat belts.
Avoid riding in overcrowded, overweight, or top-heavy vehicles.
Check the Association for Safe International Road Travel website for driving hazards or risks by country.
Organizations and governments worldwide realize the importance of road safety. So there are events all over the world aimed at making it safer to get to where you need to be. The organization BREAK lists some of these events on its website at break.org.
To look at road safety conditions around the world, check out an interactive map sponsored by the WHO. You can find it by going to the website or by typing WHO Death on the Roads into any search engine.
And that's the Health and Lifestyle Report.
I'm Brian Lynn.
And I'm Anna Mateo.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. During the second half of the 19th century, the United States was not concerned much with events in other countries. It was too busy dealing with events inside its own borders. At that time, the nation was recovering from the Civil War. It was expanding to the West, and it was developing industries. As production increased, the United States began trading more and more with other countries. At the same time, it needed a new foreign policy to defend its interests. Morris Joyce and Larry West discuss America's foreign policy in the late 1800s.
A growing number of lawmakers called for a new foreign policy. One was Henry Cabot Lodge of Massachusetts. Lodge said, "The great nations of the world were taking control of the world's undeveloped areas." As one of the great nations, Lodge said, "The United States must not fall out of this line of march." Another lawmaker said, "Fate has written our policy. The trade of the world must and shall be ours." Some of these ideas came from the writings of Captain Alfred Mahan. He was head of America's Naval War College. Mahan wrote that all the great nations in history had possessed great sea power. He said the United States must build up its sea power, too, if it wanted to be a great nation. Sea power, Mahan said, was more than a strong navy. It was an economy that could produce goods for export. It was trade ships that could carry the goods. It was colonies that could supply raw materials and markets. And it was overseas naval bases that could defend American interests far from home.
The Washington Post newspaper described America's growing power this way: "A new understanding seems to have come upon us, an understanding of our strength, and with it, a new feeling. We want to show our strength. We are face to face with a strange fate. The taste of empire is in the mouth of the people." The Washington Post was not speaking for everyone, of course. In fact, many American presidents of the late 1800s did not have this taste for empire. Yet, they were forced to face the future. Changes were coming, and it was their responsibility to guide the nation through the changes. For this reason, the United States entered into several agreements with foreign lands during the late 1800s.
In 1878, for example, the United States signed a treaty with Samoa. The United States agreed to help the South Pacific Islands settle any differences with other nations. A few years later, the treaty was put to a test. A group of Germans living in Samoa forced the island's ruler from power. They replaced him with a ruler who was more friendly to Germany. For a time, it seemed the United States and Germany would go to war. But when American warships arrived in Samoa, so did a big storm. The storm smashed both American and German ships. Neither side was left with a force strong enough to fight. In 1889, the United States, Germany, and Britain agreed that Samoa should be an independent kingdom. For 10 years, local leaders attempted to establish a strong government. Their efforts failed. In 1899, Germany took control of Samoa's large western islands. The United States took control of the smaller islands to the east.
Events in another group of Pacific Ocean islands affected American foreign policy in the late 1800s. These were the Hawaiian Islands. Hawaii was an important port for American trade ships sailing between the United States and China. Good relations between Hawaii and the United States were necessary to keep the port open to American ships. In 1891, Liliuokalani became Queen of Hawaii. She was not friendly to the United States. A group of American businessmen and planters in Hawaii plotted to oust her. The group started an uprising. Then it called on the United States for protection. Queen Liliuokalani was forced to surrender. The businessmen and planters formed a new government. They wanted Hawaii to be part of the United States. By the end of the century, Congress had made Hawaii an American territory.
The United States also offered to serve as a negotiator in several international disputes during the late 1800s. One dispute involved Britain and Venezuela. Both countries claimed land that bordered the British colony of Guyana on the northeast coast of South America. The situation became tense when gold was discovered in the disputed area. The United States offered to negotiate an agreement. Britain refused the offer. The United States offered again. Britain refused again. Finally, President Grover Cleveland asked the United States Congress to appoint a committee to decide the border. Before the American committee had a chance to meet, Britain and Venezuela agreed to let an international committee decide.
In 1895, Cuban rebels revolted against the colonial government. They tried to destroy the economy of the island by burning private property. Spain sent a large force to Cuba to crush the revolt. Thousands of persons were arrested and put into prison camps. Many died of hunger and disease. Spain was denounced for its cruelty.
It was difficult to get a true picture of what was happening in Cuba. American newspapers sent reporters to the island. But much of what they wrote about never happened. The reporters knew very well that exciting and horrifying stories sold newspapers. So, they made up stories about bloody battles and Spanish cruelty. One incident has become famous in American newspaper history. Publisher William Randolph Hearst sent artist Frederick Remington to Cuba to paint pictures of the fighting. Remington spent several months in Havana. He saw no fighting. He sent Hearst a message. Things were quiet, Remington said. There would be no war. Hearst sent back this answer. You supply the pictures. I'll supply the war.
The newspaper built up strong public feeling against Spain. Soon, many Americans were calling for war to free Cuba from Spanish rule. William McKinley was president. He did not want the United States to become involved. He did, however, offer to help Spain find a solution that would return peace to the island. Spain refused the offer. It attempted to improve the situation in Cuba by itself. Spain called home the military commander accused of cruelty. It stopped putting people in prison camps. It offered equal political rights to all Cubans, and it promised them self-rule in the future.
President McKinley welcomed Spain's policy statements. He felt Spain should be left alone to honor its promises to the Cuban people. He said the United States would not interfere. At about that time, however, riots broke out in Havana. President McKinley said it was his responsibility to protect the lives and property of Americans living there. So he sent the battleship Maine to Havana. During the early weeks of 1898, President McKinley waited for Spain to act on its promises to Cuba. He saw little progress. Relations between the United States and Spain became tense. Then, on the night of February 15th, a powerful explosion shook the battleship Maine in Havana Harbor. The ship sank. More than 250 American sailors were dead.
No one knew what caused the explosion on the battleship Maine. The United States said it was an underwater bomb. Spain said it was something on the ship itself. There was some evidence the explosion was caused by an accident in the ship's fuel tanks. Yet, some people in the United States blamed Spain anyway. They demanded war. They cried, "Remember the Maine!"
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.